Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Next month, the European Union will begin enforcing what advocates are calling the most comprehensive set of 21st century digital privacy laws in the world. They're sweeping new consumer protections that put users, not tech companies, in control of their own data. Now, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg told Congress that he would extend those privacy controls beyond Europe, but maybe not, because there's news recently that Facebook is quietly moving 1.5 billion global users in a way that might put their data beyond the reach of the EU's new rules. So the question is, why can't Americans enjoy similar digital privacy laws, similar legal protections? Well, when you read the fine print, it turns out that the EU's version of privacy may clash with American notions of free speech. This hour on Point, new data protections in the EU and what they could mean for privacy in the U.S. In the wake of the Cambridge Analytica scandal and the fact that 87 million Facebook users' data was used without their consent for political purposes, do you think it's high time that EU-style private digital privacy laws came to the United States? Or are you concerned with things like the right to be forgotten, and could that inadvertently lead to censorship or blocking free speech in the United States? Also, speaking of tech, you can find us online at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, I've been talking a lot about Mark Zuckerberg here, so let's just remind folks that Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook did testify before Congress in the wake of the Cambridge Analytica scandal. And during that testimony, Democratic Texas Congressman Gene Green asked Zuckerberg how international differences in data privacy protections could affect American Facebook users.
Did I understand correctly that Facebook would not only make the same settings available, but that will make the same protections available to Americans that they will the Europeans?
Yes, Congressman, all the same controls will be available around the world.
Okay. And you commit today that Facebook will extend the same protections to Americans that European users will receive under the GDPR?
Yes, Congressman, we believe that everyone around the world deserves good privacy controls. We've had a lot of these controls in place for years. The GDPR requires us to do a few more things, and we're going to extend that to the world.
That's Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg testifying before Congress there. So you heard them mention this thing, the GDPR. Those are the European Union's new rules set to go into effect next month. Joining us now to explain is Tom Wheeler. He was chairman of the Federal Communications Commission here in the United States from 2013 to 2017 under President Obama. He's now a fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Tom Wheeler, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Meghna. Good to be here.
So first of all, let's just start with the GDPR 101 here. When we say that, what do we mean? General data protection regulations. What is the European Union about to do?
Well, they're going to do something that is a first. I mean, you can consider it crossing the Rubicon, I guess, maybe crossing the digital Rubicon. And the effect of it will be, for the first time, to reorient what is happening online around the consumer and the consumer's information rather than around the company. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are two principal issues here, I think. One is that developers tend to build first and then think, what are the consequences later?
Right.
And business people seize on that to say, well, the more data that we can collect, the greater the targeting that we can sell. And so what GDPR tries to do is to go at both of those by first saying you have to have privacy by design.
Uh-huh.
It has to be a forethought, not an afterthought. And then you need to make the collection of the information fit the usage, because right now what we have going on is How can you siphon off as much information as possible, even though it really isn't necessary to the delivery of this particular service?
Right. So just to, so let's go down here a degree to the level of some of the specific things. So that's the sort of big umbrella in terms of the shift in who should have control over the data. But some of the specific measures that, you know, regarding consent, right? Companies
right.
won't be able to use vague or confusing language in their terms of service. I suppose those terms of service that only the most obsessive amongst us even read right now. And they're not going to be able to bundle consent for different things together. That's interesting
right.
to me because beforehand, I mean, you just had to scroll through pages and pages and pages of legalistic language. So the EU is going to do away with all that and just make it more clear and separate in terms of what you're opting into and saying yes to?
Yeah, the key concept here is that it's the consumer's information. And the consumer has the right to provide informed consent about what's being collected and how it's being used. So they need to opt in before the information can be collected. They can't be coerced into, well, if you don't say we can have this information, then we won't give you the service. It can't be hidden in paragraph 87 of the legal fine print.
Right.
And probably one of the hidden things here is the concept of portability, where your information remains your information, even if it's on somebody else's server, and you can take it with you because it's yours, not theirs.
Okay, so what are some of the implications of that?
Well, I think the implications are that it's going to force companies to think about privacy first, rather than scramble to catch up. I mean, with all due respect, and there have been incredible things that we have seen developed and coming out of Silicon Valley, and we should all celebrate that. But the ethos has tended to be, well, let's see if we can build, you know, fill in the blank, and then we'll deal with the consequences later on.
Yeah, the move fast, break things,
exactly.
To quote Zuckerberg.
Exactly. And I think what GDPR is saying, no. You have to do it by design. You have to say, here's what I need to deliver on this product that I am building.
Yeah.
And that's what you can get. You got to think about privacy ahead of time rather than after the fact.
So again, just a little bit more detail here. I mean, the new EU rules are going to require that for children under the age of 16, someone with parental responsibility has to opt in to all of this. There's going to be mandatory guidelines for companies that they have to notify the data protection authority in their country about a data breach within 72 hours of
right.
becoming aware of it. That's really interesting. And then this is one I want to come back to in detail in a second, but I just want to mention it now. The right to be forgotten. And that is, you can ask whoever is controlling your data to erase it and potentially stop third parties from processing it as well. That's the one I think that could be a little sticky here in the United States. And so I'm going to come back to that in a second. But Tom Wheeler, I mean, just give me your take here. What's preventing similar laws from being made here in the United States? I mean, the EU is also, I should mention, adding some teeth to it, right? Like, companies can be fined up to 20 million euros if they don't
right.
comply.
Well, Magna, you know, we tried to do this when I was chairman of the FCC insofar as the networks that connect you to the internet are. You know, we spent a lot of time in the last couple of weeks focusing on Facebook, but Facebook is one website, right, or
yeah.
several websites. The networks that take you there, AT&T or Comcast or whomever, they see all the websites you go to. They see everything you're doing. So we put in place rules that were very similar in concept and opt-in concept in the transparency of what information's being collected that applied to the networks. We couldn't apply them to the platforms like Facebook and Google because the FCC doesn't have jurisdiction. But we applied it where we had jurisdiction. And 67 days after the Trump Republican Congress came in, Congress passed a law repealing it. And went so far as to say that the FCC to pass a law that said the FCC could never again have those kind of privacy rules.
Hmm.
So we have a basic underpinning issue in the United States where there needs to be a willingness of our elected officials to step up and say, no, I represent the consumers whose information privacy is being violated. And that hasn't been the orientation of the Congress to this point.
Yeah. Well, we'll come back to that in a moment. You're listening to Tom Wheeler. He was chairman of the FCC from 2013 to 2017 under President Obama. We're talking about the European Union and the fact that next month it's about to begin enforcing what's possibly the most comprehensive 21st century set of data privacy laws. And, you know, the details around that and the implications for the rest of the world, including data privacy here in the United States. Tom, stand by for just a quick second because I want to bring into the conversation Alex Hearn. He's a tech reporter for The Guardian UK, and he joins us from London because we want to get the view here from Europe. Alex, welcome to On Point.
Thanks. Hi, Magna.
So Tom Wheeler sort of got us started in talking about the details of these new EU regulations around data privacy. We just got a minute here before the break because I want to quickly ask you, has there been any pushback in the European Union itself from tech companies about the sweeping nature of these new rules?
I think we've had a very interesting timing. Until about November, almost no one, even within the EU, was really paying much attention to it. A lot of companies were waiting for the official guidance published by the European Union's Article 29 Working Party, which is a bit of a mouthful, but it's the European body which provides guidance, which provides oversight for these areas. Come November, that was published, and companies then realized that actually GDPR was quite a lot larger than they thought it was going to be. But, you know, they began the process of working through it, of talking about it. And then I think just at the moment when they might start campaigning, the Facebook scandal broke.
Right. So hang in there for a second. Just a second, Alex, because we have to take a quick break here. But we're going to pick up where you left off. That's Alex Hearn. He's tech reporter for The Guardian UK. We're also joined today by Tom Wheeler, former FCC chairman. And we're talking about the European Union's new digital privacy laws and whether we could see anything like that here in the United States. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Ever listen to the news and wonder, is there anything good happening out there? I'm Mindy Thomas from NPR's Wow in the World. And each week, Guy Raz and I take you and your kids on wild adventures to explore the most wow-worthy news stories on the planet. Find Wow in the World on Apple Podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the European Union's new sweeping digital privacy laws set to be enforced beginning next month and what effect that might have on digital privacy worldwide. You can join us. Do you think the United States needs to have stronger digital privacy laws here, something with real teeth in it like the European Union has? Or are you slightly concerned that maybe the EU is going too far with things like its right to be forgotten and could that trample on American notions of free speech online? I'm joined today by Tom Wheeler. He was former chairman of the FCC from 2013 to 2017. He's now a fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. And by Alex Hearn, tech reporter for The Guardian UK. He's with us from London. Alex, before the break there, you were talking about the fact that even in the European Union, with the sweeping change, many people weren't paying attention to the coming changes until the Cambridge Analytica scandal broke.
Exactly. Well, it was all about the same time, really, that over the past, it's only really been 4 or 5 months that anyone except the extreme specialists have been paying attention. And I think just as the lobbying effort might have kicked in to Top Gear, just as the public was starting to become aware of GDPR, the Facebook scandal broke and completely changed the tenor of the conversation. I don't think right now you would get much leeway if you tried to argue that there isn't a serious institutional problem with the way data is handled across the world, but in Europe as much as anywhere else.
You know, I am seeing here, though, since we're talking about Facebook again, it is the 800 or actually £2 billion gorilla in the room here, that even though Mark Zuckerberg, when testifying before Congress, said that he was going to, they're going to unroll GDPR-type controls, mm-hmm. for Facebook users around the world, which they are doing. Simultaneously, just last week, you reported in The Guardian that Facebook is quietly moving data for 1.5 billion global users away from its Irish terms of service into U.S. terms of service. What's going on there?
So it's not data that they're moving.
Okay.
It's important to be clear that all they're doing is they're changing the terms of service that users outside of Europe and the US and Canada agree to. It used to be that the US and Canada agreed to terms of service, you know, a binding legal contract with Facebook's Menlo Park headquarters, and everywhere else in the world agreed to terms of service operated through Ireland, which is Facebook's international HQ. Now, if you're outside of Europe, that document is officially an agreement with Facebook Incorporated, with the U.S. body of Facebook.
Okay, I was just going to say, does that mean that if their user wanted to take legal action, they would have to do it in a U.S. court versus an Irish one?
Almost certainly, exactly that. It's one of those things, one of the interesting things about European law really across the board, and GDPR is no exception, is it's created and enforced somewhat differently from US and UK law. It tends to be sort of deliberately vague until after it gets worked out through national level enforcement, through national level case law, and through the way it gets written into national governments. All of which is to say that I have not been able to get a clear answer, even from experts in this area, about what the effect of this change actually is. Facebook's given its clear answer. Facebook says that the reason why it did that is just to make it easier to do things like notify individuals outside of the EU of data breaches, because GDPR and now the Irish Terms of Service include a few specific European, unique to Europe phrases like data protection controller, which Facebook says isn't really relevant if you're outside of Europe.
But on the other hand, you're quoting folks like privacy researchers who say moving 1.5 billion users into other jurisdictions is not a simple copy and paste exercise. So there's more going on here.
Exactly that. So the thing is, other people are arguing that this change does actually have a significant effect, specifically in terms of who is liable, who can leave Facebook liable for these swinging fines that GDPR allows European data controllers to levy,
right,
up to 4% of global turnover, which is billions in Facebook's case.
Okay, so let me just go back to Tom Wheeler here. Tom, I heard you want to jump in there, because I'm just curious what you make of all this, and then I guess that leads me to the question of, like, what effect really might these EU regulations have globally, if any?
So, Meghna, I think that Alex made a really good point about how we're in the first inning. Sorry, Alex, I'm going to use an American sports metaphor. We're in the first inning of this. And what is significant is that the game is on. As I said, it's crossing a Rubicon here. And what's going to have to happen is that national governments and the EU and the US are going to have to come to grips with, okay, how do we implement these kinds of ideas specifically? What, you know, as a former regulator, I can tell you that what legislators do is to give you broad parameters, because they can't get that detailed in a piece of legislation, and things change too rapidly. And so what a regulator has to do is say, okay, here are the broad concepts I have to operate in. How do I reflect this, these concepts against the reality that I find? And therefore, you end up getting shades of gray. We debate things in terms of black and white, but the actual implementation is much more nuanced. And that's what we're going to see now. We're now moving into how do you effectuate this kind of concept that the consumer comes first. I mean, That is a huge step.
So, Tom, let me just jump in here, because that leads me directly to the one part of the GDPR, of these new EU regulations that we haven't explored in depth and really need to, about the right to be forgotten. Alex, can you just walk us through briefly, like, what that means in terms of these new data privacy laws?
So the right to be forgotten isn't a new right in the European Union. It's it was established as a corollary of the right to privacy a few years back. And so far, until the introduction of GDPR, it has been interpreted as allowing individuals to demand the removal of outdated or misleading information about them. It's largely been applied almost entirely, really, in the public sphere through requests made to Google. To remove search entries about individuals. Some of that is obviously exactly what you'd expect. It is people who were, you know, in an embarrassing situation in their school days, who 20 years on would just like the local newspaper article about how they ran naked through the university quad to maybe not be the top result for their for a search of their name. It has been contested quite heavily for more specific instances. There was a court case in London just this month in which there were a lot of reporting restrictions on it, but in which two men sued Google to remove two news articles about former criminal conviction.
Right. Okay. So this
following GDPR. Sorry, go on.
No. Go ahead. You go finish that thought, and then I want to bring in another guest to respond to this.
Following GDPR, it's been made much more explicit. It introduces a right for individuals to have personal data erased. They can make a request. They have to get a response within 1 month. But GDPR is also very explicit that the right is not absolute. It only applies in certain situations. If the personal data is no longer necessary for the purpose it was gathered, or if it specifically has stronger implications for data gathered around children.
Right.
You know, there are checks and balances built into this.
Okay, great.
As there were before, but they are different, I think, from the checks and balances that the U.S. would settle for on its own.
So on that point, since you did mention that this has been sort of adjudicated in European courts a couple of times, I just want to play a bit of tape here, because in 2014, there was this landmark case in the European Court of Justice over the right to be forgotten. And Alex, as you mentioned, giving people the right to ask Google to remove unwanted links from search results. And just after that ruling came out, Craig Newman, who's a lawyer, explained it to CNN shortly after the ruling was handed down.
You have a right to call Google and say, I want to take that down. But that information is already lawfully on the internet. So it's a bit like saying, it's okay to have this book in your library, but you're not allowed to use Google as a card catalog to find it.
And as Alex Hearn was just telling us, the new European Union regulations go even further, giving people the right not just to be forgotten, but to ask companies to delete their data. So I want to get some response on that point from Scott Shackelford. He's a professor of business law at Indiana University's Kelly School of Business. He specializes in cybersecurity and privacy. He joins us from Bloomington, Indiana. Scott Shackelford, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Megna. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So about this right to be forgotten, I think that this is the one that Alex Hearn was rightly saying could be the most legally challenging in the United States, because as far as I understand it, it does put the power of requesting the deletion of information off the internet in the hands of consumers, but doesn't that sort of run headlong into First Amendment laws here in the United States?
No, that's right. And as Alex said, it's not even absolute in the EU. So this has to be balanced against free expression there. But as you guys are talking about, the balancing act and how that would play out in the U.S. is going to be pretty different. The U.S. and the European Union for some time now have actually been diverging in how we think of privacy rights. What counts as news? What are the privacy rights even of public figures, right? And that divergence is really coming into play when we think about how these EU concepts like GDPR and the right to be forgotten are going to be applied in U.S. courtrooms, because, as I'm sure is going to be no surprise to your listeners, we have a really robust tradition of free speech and free expression here, which could run pretty headlong against this idea.
Yeah. Do you think that the thresholds that Alex Hearn was describing for the right to be forgotten are Again, this is European Union specific. It hasn't happened in the United States, but are the thresholds, you know, high enough, or could they be even higher? Like, should there be a period of time where due process can be applied before the information is removed or deleted? Because it's not clear to me if there's a significant amount of time in the EU regulations as they stand.
That's right. We should keep in mind that all that's out so far, except for some recitals, is this 88-page regulation. So if anybody's looking for some solid summer beach reading, look no further. But a lot of the rules remain to be written beyond that, right? So including how we're going to balance, for example, these due process considerations against the right to be forgotten. So right now it just says under Article 17, you got to do this without undue delay. There's some time frames that have been mentioned, like a month, but it's unclear, for example, how much further you have to go to ensure that this data is taken down. There's some language in there about reasonable steps to inform these kind of quote-unquote controllers about this data, and they have to take take active steps to get that data down unless it would require a disproportionate effort. So again, the proof is in the pudding, how you define things like disproportionate effort.
Let's get a quick call in here. Nick is calling from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. You're on the air, Nick.
Hi, Magna. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, I'm very encouraged by this EU bill, and I'm really excited about the implications for it. The main things I'm interested in are the right to be forgotten, which seems like a very important thing, and if we were to ever create like a digital bill of rights, I feel like that would definitely be one of those rights. So I guess my questions are, how exactly is that right to be forgotten going to work in the EU? You know, for instance, we were talking about the school kid who ran naked in the hallway. You know, at this time with super cookies and the way these companies work and everything, I really feel like they're trying to make your online presence more of like a resume or a credit report. And that really isn't what this was all designed for, and I'm wondering if that's part of what this is aiming at, these EU regulations.
Nick, thank you so much for your call. Alex Hearn, let me turn back to you briefly on that. And I've got a couple other follow-ups along Nick's question as well. Like, does the right to be forgotten apply to third-party companies who might have access to that same information that people want deleted as well?
Well, so firstly, on how's it going to be enforced in general, I mean, this isn't entirely hypothetical. Like I say, it's already a right which applies in the EU. If you want to ironically Google EU privacy removal, you will end up on Google's right to be forgotten form, which asks you for information including your country of origin, whether you're acting on behalf of yourself, a family member, a friend, and then you have to give the URL you want to remove, the names that it shouldn't show up for a search, and then Google passes it through to a panel of lawyers who assess it and decide whether or not to remove it. This isn't hypothetical. It's already happening. Whether or not, you know, issues like how you remove it from a third party are more difficult. It's something which all of these rights are running headlong into. There is a data ecosystem. Information gets passed beyond it. Information gets collected by one company and passed on and on,
right,
and on and on.
So,
and yeah, there's not yet a clear level of responsibility in terms of how far down that chain the initial data collector has to go. Most obviously, that's what Facebook has fallen prey to recently. It controlled information, handed it off to third-party app developers, and now hasn't been able to really tell anyone what happened to it after that fact.
Tom Wheeler, I heard you want to jump in there.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Magda. So, you know, Scott made a really good point where he said that these are issues that are yet to be fleshed out and need to be determined in more detail by both regulators and court. And this is a process that we go through with everything. You know, we have a robust free speech right in this country, but it's agreed that that does not include the right to yell fire in a crowded theater. So how do we fill in the open spaces? And that's something that will be a matter of public debate in a regulatory process, in the judicial process, for years to come. And so we need to be careful that we don't talk about this in terms of taking the GDPR and cutting it, pasting it into U.S. law. First, we've got to say we're going to step up to this issue. I mean, it's fascinating that, you know, the Republicans who were pushing Mark Zuckerberg in both the House and Senate are the same Republicans that voted to repeal the privacy rules that we put in place at the FCC. So let's step up to it, and then let's deal with these kinds of nuances as we implement it. But we have failed that first test to step up, and at least the EU has stepped up to begin the discussion of how do you color in the spaces.
Right. Alex Hearn, we've just got a minute here before the break. So I'm curious, is there discussion in the EU? I mean, given the global nature of digital information, is there discussion in the EU about just how much these new laws could actually have impacts in other jurisdictions? I mean, obviously, we're focused here on the United States, but Asia, Africa, et cetera.
There is quite a lot of discussion. I think the two thrusts that I've heard recently are, one, a hope that it will prompt sort of leveling up, that other data regulators will see the EU laws, see that they've not destroyed the internet sector in Europe, that Facebook hasn't pulled out, and decide that actually, yeah, you know what, we want a piece of that. We're letting our own citizens down. I've already heard murmurings from Australia and New Zealand in particular that this might be a thing that they'd like. And obviously, during the Mark Zuckerberg testimony in front of the Senate and the House, a lot of legislators there expressed a desire to copy the EU.
Well, Alex, I'm going to jump in here because we just got to take another quick break. Alex Hearn, tech reporter for The Guardian UK, speaking to us from London. Alex, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And we've also got Tom Wheeler and Scott Shackelford still with us. We'll hear more from them and from you, the callers and listeners, after the break. We're talking about the EU's new digital privacy laws set to take in effect next month and what it means for digital privacy here in the United States. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
What's unique about the human experience, and what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the European Union's new data privacy laws and whether or not we could or want to see similar regulations here in the United States. I'm joined today by Tom Wheeler, former chairman of the FCC from 2013 to 2017, and also by Scott Shackelford, professor of business law at Indiana University's Kelly School of Business. And Scott, I just wanted to ask you a quick question, because we are seeing some concern about the extent that the EU's laws do go to. I mean, members of the Trump administration, the Secretary of Homeland Security, for example, was starting to express some worry about whether or not these new privacy regulations might actually inhibit, I don't know, investigators looking into cyber attacks, for example. I mean, she was quoted as saying, through trying to protect a citizen's privacy, we eliminate the ability of many of vendors, these are cybersecurity vendors and researchers who otherwise would have access to data to see trends in attacks. Is that a legitimate concern?
It's a good point. And that's honestly typically not discussed very much in the GDPR context. Usually the conversation begins and ends with privacy. But there's significant data security and breach notification requirements built into that. And as you say, some are good and some are bad. So, for example, the GDPR expands the definition of what counts as a data breach and even a broader definition of what's personal data. So in the U.S., for example, not all private data is created equal, right? It matters if it's financial data or health data. We build in protections around that sorts of stuff. In the EU, this is even going to cover your IP address, right? So there's good stuff there. You're going to get faster notifications. It even requires companies to do postmortems after data breaches to figure out what went wrong and how can they do a better job in the future to make sure it doesn't happen again, kind of similar to how the NTSB investigates air accidents, right, like we've unfortunately seen recently. But there's also some standards in there that weaken, that are a bit lower than what we have in the U.S., surprisingly, I think. So, for example, it narrows the scope of who gets notified. There's no expectation of credit monitoring, no walls of shame like we have in the U.S. as well. And also, it's important to note that GDPR doesn't really apply to national security and to law enforcement investigations, right? So I'm not exactly sure where the Trump administration is coming from on that point, but it is important to just kind of put out there, this isn't a panacea, and you should definitely see the benefits, but also some of the drawbacks in it as well.
Right. So, I mean, in the White House's view, the White House Cyber Coordinator Rob Joyce tweeted pointed out that he believes that GDPR would, quote, undercut a key tool for identifying malicious domains on the internet. So, I mean, I think we keep hearing over and over in the course of this hour that that we'll really see once the EU starts enforcing the law exactly how it's going to play out in reality. But I want to get some calls in here before I run out of too much time. Jamal is calling from Detroit. You're on the air, Jamal.
Hey, how you doing today?
I'm doing great.
My comment is that this is the data age. And so, you know, everything around us generates some type of data, where, you know, whether you are doing something or not, even your inactivity generates data. And so we're going to have to build the infrastructure for this data age, just like we had codes to better improve building structure, you know, and construction and stuff like that. We're going to have to really take this on and not choke off growth, but we're definitely going to have to build the infrastructure for this data age.
Jamal, thank you so much for your call. Tom Wheeler, what's your response?
Jamal's spot on. And the question is, who makes those rules? Do the people, through their representatives, make the rules, or do the powerful, those who profit by the use of your information and mine, make those rules? And I think it's pretty clear cut that we can't continue a situation where privacy is an afterthought. It needs to be something that is that it is your privacy, it is my privacy, and I have the right to control it and to say what happens to it.
Emily is calling from Saranac Lake, New York. You're on the air, Emily.
Thank you, Magna, for taking my call. My question is, since we're talking about content online, does the fact that we're talking about online content, which is immediately, once it's online, turned into data, undermine or change this notion of it being free speech?
So tell me a little bit more about what you're saying, Emily. Are you just saying that the sheer fact that it goes online converts it to speech? Okay. So speech equals data.
Right.
Is that what you're wondering?
Or does it?
Okay.
Does it equal that you have the right to say it online, but once it's online, it's data? And do those have the same rights as speech?
Okay, great. Scott Shackelford, I'm going to turn to you for your take on that.
Right. No, it's a great question as well. There's always a search for analogies here when we talk about data. Sometimes it's the gold of the digital age. I've heard it described as the asbestos of the digital age as well. And in terms of the free speech rights you get from data, though, frankly, lawyers love to say it, but it's true. It depends, right? It depends. Once the data is up there, the internet is written in ink. Absolutely. It is really tough to take down. It can be copied. It's tough to go after those copies to make sure it's gone. So in discussions of data portability, as you talked about with Chairman Wheeler and right to be forgotten, it's tough. In the U.S., you know, typically once it's up there, once it's free speech, we build in a lot of protections around that speech. If anything, we've expanded the types of things that count as constitutionally protected speech over time, which again is going to be make it interesting as we debate through, for example, the proposed Consent Act or otherwise, kind of where we go next and how we respond to GDPR.
You know, Scott and Tom, one thing that we haven't discussed and right now is the business implications here, because right now, yes, there is a microscope, a global microscope on this issue of data privacy because of Cambridge Analytica, Facebook, et cetera. But, you know, that data, that information is it is what these companies sell. It's how they make their money. I mean, so after maybe that microscope pulls back a little bit and people relax, which I suppose inevitably they do in the cycle of things, I mean, are we then likely to see companies say, well, maybe this isn't so great because are these regulations making it harder for them to do the business they do, Scott?
Mm-hmm. It's a good point as well. And it's important just to be clear up front here that we've been talking a lot about Facebook and tech companies, but even if you are a U.S. company and you don't have any if you don't have an office, if you don't have employees in the EU, you can still be covered by GDPR just by dint of having an internet presence, e-commerce, logistics, travel and hospitality, you name it. So it casts a really, really wide net. And absolutely, as a result of that, there's a lot of built-in protections that we got to keep in mind. And for, you know, tech companies in particular, it's unclear what's going to be the end result. There was a great piece in the New York Times just yesterday that it could actually be a boon for companies like Facebook and Google because it's going to raise barriers to entry and make it more expensive to comply with these requirements. So maybe that's going to quash some startups who could otherwise get some footing.
Tom Wheeler, do you buy that? I mean, to me, that almost, I don't know. I feel like that's maybe a little, not that Scott Shackelford is spinning, but it's like it's sort of trying to put a shine on something that Facebook probably, in its heart of hearts, does not like.
Yeah, you're right.
Well, you know, before I was chairman of the FCC, I was a partner in a venture capital firm. So I dealt with companies that had to compete with Facebook and Google. And they already have huge advantages. You know, I mean, Google controls, what, 80% of all search ads. Facebook controls over 60% of all logins. I mean, they already have huge reach, which delivers huge amounts of data, which creates huge barriers to entry. What's interesting about GDPR, we talked about it previously, is this idea of the portability of my data. Because if I am empowered to take my data from Facebook to a new startup because I like what they do better and I like their privacy better, then I've got a role as a consumer in helping to identify what those new companies will look like and not have them squashed by the giants.
Right, and that's the heart of it, right? Reorienting the notion of who really has control and ownership of this data. Absolutely fascinating. Tom Wheeler, former chairman of the FCC from 2013 to 2017 under President Obama, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Megan.
And Scott Shackelford, professor of business law at Indiana University's Kelly School of Business. Real pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much.
Pleasure's all mine. Thank you.
In a moment, what Peter Thiel's data mining company, we're going to talk about that a little bit more, knows about you. It's a lot more than you think. This is On Point. Well, have you heard of Palantir? It's the company PayPal co-founder Peter Thiel has. It's a data mining company, and it was originally designed for counterterrorism efforts. But a new investigation by Bloomberg News shows that the company is using war on terror tools to track private U.S. citizens. Joining me now from San Francisco is Peter Waldman. He's one of the Bloomberg reporters who authored this investigation. We've got a link to the story at onpointradio.org. Peter, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Meghna.
So first of all, just quickly tell us, for those folks who don't know, what exactly is Palantir?
So Palantir is a Silicon Valley company. It started in 2004 after the attacks of 2001, and it basically exists to help the Pentagon, the CIA, and others track down terrorists, amass and to synthesize and analyze intelligence on the battlefields overseas. And later that decade, around 2008, 9, and 10, it got brought back to America because Palantir, like every Silicon Valley company, found ways to leverage its data analysis to the private sector. So here we have it marketed to banks, to large institutions, corporations of all kinds, and to local law enforcement in the United States.
I see. You have police and sheriff's departments in New York, New Orleans, Chicago, and Los Angeles all having used it.
Among others, what happens is the Department of Homeland Security has quite a bit of money to help law enforcement at all levels synthesize and sort of fuse their intelligence gathering capabilities. This was in the aftermath of the terror attacks on 9/11 when they decided, well, hey, we could have actually detected these people when they came into the country with this plan, and if we had shared intelligence better among different levels of our law enforcement, we would have figured that one out. So there's a lot of federal money that is helping local law enforcement, and Palantir was an early beneficiary of that. Again, back to around 2009, it started to help set up these fusion centers where its software platform is widely used to integrate and synthesize intelligence. Basically, what Palantir does, I think it's important to understand, it doesn't spy itself, nor do its software engineers. What they do, they come in and set up the software platform for the agencies and then they have access to all of the databases that the agency has. So if it's law enforcement, it's criminal records, driving records, all the kinds of things the state collects, but then it goes well beyond that, too, to scraping the web for social media and, oh, things like camera surveillance in parking lots and hospitals and universities. And, of course, with facial recognition, that gets you a long way in figuring out who's doing what. It's quite a tool when it spits out this sort of image or what we call spidergram of links, a link analysis that exists on a screen that any law enforcement person with access can see, or any corporate executive or security person who's looking at it can suddenly see these connections that sprawl all over the target's life.
Right. I mean, you say that like the connections include, you know, showing who they're connected through as colleagues, who they live with, brothers and sisters, even lovers, what kind of vehicles they own. Now, so it's a lot of information about just average Americans. I presume, though, regarding law enforcement, local law enforcement departments that are using it, you know, as you mentioned, because of these fusion centers, there's still a counterterrorism argument for the use of this information. But I'm also interested in the fact that you said in the private sector, banks like J.P. Morgan are using what Palantir has to offer. I mean, they're buying this information for what?
So we have an extended vignette in our article about J.P. Morgan, because they were one of the first corporate users in the United States, and really it's where we see Palantir coming from the war on terror to the weaponization of data against Americans at home. Basically, at J.P. Morgan, what happened was the people in the security department, in particular one of the top forensic investigators there, whose job was to really track and watch employees for potential abuse of corporate assets. They had a huge trading loss in London, the London Whale incident, mm-hmm. Back before 2009, and they set up this system essentially to monitor employees. What it did was it tracked everything. If they had a company-issued cell phone, the GPS would tell them where that employee was at any given time. They could synthesize and read transcriptions of the digitally recorded phone conversations in and out of J.P. Morgan premises. They could watch and see when you badged in and when you badged out, and they literally set up a system that warned them via Palantir when an employee changed their badge-in pattern. So they said, well, this employee always came in at 8:30. Now they're coming in at 11. Maybe they're disgruntled. Maybe that takes further scrutiny of their communications, and they might check out their emails or even track them physically after hours. So
wow.
It led to quite a dragnet of monitoring and ultimately a spying scandal within the bank, and J.P. Morgan essentially dropped using Palantir after 2013. Mind you, the scandal was interesting. Actually, the top executives fell under the dragnet, and this individual, this former Secret Service agent who ran the forensic investigations, was actually spying on some top executives and looking at their communications and sharing them with an outside executive, and that's what brought it down. Doesn't seem like the top executives were all that concerned with everyone else, but when it turned on them, they sort of turned off the switch.
Ah, as these things happen. Okay, so, I mean, you also note in your investigation that Lord of the Rings fans will recognize the name Palantir. It is a reference to one of those sort of all-omniscient crystal balls the wizards use in Palantir. But we've just got 30 seconds here left to go, Peter. I'm curious. You said that Palantir is now marketing this data, this information, heavily in the private sector. I mean, again, we just got 20 seconds here. What do you think the implications are of this?
Well, you don't want it to fall into the hands of employers who use it carelessly or unmindfully, such that they're actually watching you, watching your buying, your spending, your family time, yeah. Your vacations, which is entirely possible. I mean, Palantir is very resourceful as a tool. Remember, it is a tool, so it's really how they use it. And you want to be careful about
right.
Who you work for and what tools they're using.
And who can afford to buy it. Peter Waldman, investigative reporter at Bloomberg, thank you so very much.
My pleasure, Magna.
And before we go, I actually want to issue a clarification and a correction. In yesterday's show, we were talking about the Democratic National Committee's lawsuit against the Trump administration. We mentioned that the DNC had sent out a fundraising email. On the back of that lawsuit, it wasn't a fundraising email. It was an email to its supporter list about the lawsuit. There was no fundraising pitch. in that email. I'm Meghan Chakrabarty. This is On Point.